Howdy. Welcome to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Here's what we're going to talk about today.
Arkansans will see a rise in insurance rates this year, but it could have been worse. Meanwhile, thousands more enroll in the state's private option.
The Republican candidate for a state House seat in South Arkansas faces jail time, and the state Republican Party says, oops.
A Sherwood court comes under pressure from the ACLU. A story of hot checks, court fines, and debtors' prisons.
Arkansas' struggle with high rates of incarceration is nothing new, but an outside group is offering ideas for how the state can deal with overcrowding.
And which counties could go wet for alcohol this November?
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
This is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Well, Jacob, the Arkansas Insurance Department released some figures this week showing what insurance rates are going to be in the upcoming...
Let's go with year.
Year, in the next year, in the next few months.
Yeah.
They're slightly lower than what insurance companies had originally asked for, but they're still higher. So what's up?
So the big story, along with the Affordable Care Act, Republicans is the big talking point, is the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act isn't maybe working out necessarily. There's been a lot of premium rate increases throughout the country in the past few years. However, in Arkansas has been relatively immune to this. In 2014 to 2015, the first year we had the marketplace going, that's where people who earn above 138% of the poverty level, who can't get plans through work, can get government subsidies to purchase private health insurance plans. It's also where Arkansas puts our Medicaid expansion population, who gets regular plans from like Blue Cross Blue Shield. Anyway, in 2014 and 2015, the premiums only went up about 2% on average, which was like one of the best in the nation, if not the best. It's unheard of to be that kind of that low. 2015 to 2016, it only went up 4.3%. Pretty great, some of the best in the country. This year, though, it's going to go up 9.1%. That's at least what the Arkansas Department of Insurance sent to federal officials for approval. But initially, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is the largest insurance provider in Arkansas, wanted a 14.7% rate hike. And any insurance company proposing a rate hike above 10% because of the Affordable Care Act has to get approval from state commissioners and the federal government. Alan Kerr, who's Arkansas's insurance commissioner, knocked that 14.7% down to 9.7. So there was a legislative committee this week where they discussed this. Alan Kerr came to testify to legislators. Here's one of the chairs, Jim Hendren, who's the Senate Majority Leader, a nephew of Governor Asa Hutchinson. He kind of questioned the wisdom of not giving them the 14.7%. I wouldn't say that Hendren was any way advocating for a certain higher percent, but he said if you're knocking it down to 9.7, you know, there must have been a reason Blue Cross asked for 14.7. So the answer seems to be that maybe next year we'll pay even more because of it being reduced this year.
I know in the comments that were in the media that there were statements that this is a one-year reprieve, that there's no way they can live with this type of margin moving forward. I guess what I would ask you is, do you have concern that we're setting ourselves up for a larger increase in 2018?
Yes, right. Sir. Well, yes and no. I mean, whatever rate we don't take this year, if we make no changes at all, if we make no corrections, course corrections at all, then yes, we're looking probably at a larger rate increase next year. As a rule, as history has shown us, Arkansas tends to move about a year behind the rest of the country in economic downturns and things like insurance rates. So to answer your question, yes, sir, we may be putting this off for another year. But what that does is that gives us something that's palatable and something that's affordable for the next 12 months while we make these course corrections and hopefully come up with a better plan.
And so, of course, legislators and the Stevens Group have been meeting for well over a year now to try to figure out what sort of changes can be done to existing insurance plans and state support for insurance to make things cheaper overall. So there's some hope from state lawmakers that that could be a solution to the rising prices. The concern is that if carriers can't raise rates enough to make the amount of money they want to make, then they could pull out of the health insurance marketplace, which basically means there's no insurance providers available for the government to subsidize. However, if they do that, they're not eligible to sell their plans in the marketplace for a period of 5 years, so they'd lose out on a big market. There have been some smaller carriers that have pulled out, but so far the big one, like Blue Cross Blue Shield, they're still in here. Counter-argument to this also, that prices could go down. Here's State Senator Linda Chesterfield of Little Rock, a Democrat. She kind of says, well, prices might be going up. That's because we just added 300,000 plus people to insurance plans who didn't have it before, so that they might be a little sick right now, but maybe they'll get healthier.
It would stand to reason that if you add 250,000 people who've never had health insurance, that the cost of health insurance would go up. Would that be about a correct assessment, Mr. Kerr?
As we've seen historically for the last 3 years, yes.
If I've never had health insurance before and I get to go to the doctor for the first time ever with diseases or conditions that have festered for years, my costs are going to go up. If I stay with that doctor for a period of time, should not the premiums then, or should not the cost of care begin to go down because the initial cost is invariably higher than the cost that come after? Would that make sense to you?
Yes, ma'am. And that's what I was trying to explain a while ago is you're when you first go in and evaluate it, you're going to have to, they're going to have to run some tests to see what's wrong with you and so forth. And then once they have that baseline, it's a maintenance situation from that point on. That's why I said I called it deferred maintenance, because for whatever your problems were, you were unaware of them, in denial, whatever the case may be. And after that point, it may be a small medication, something along those lines, to keep you straight.
So that's like one perspective on why rates are the way they are. Here's Charlie Collins, who's definitely way more conservative than Linda Chesterfield. He's a Republican from Fayetteville. He's also a co-chair. He made an analogy about hamburgers to describe what's going on.
I'm too dumb to look at the little tiny pieces, so I'm going to give you my view of what happened. D.C. said, we're going to give free health care out. We used to subsidize it in the emergency rooms with Emtala. We're going to pull those subsidies away, and we're now going to do it by giving you your Medicaid taxes back. When we do that, we're always going to make the same assumption. Just like if you ran a free buffet. Before it was free, Jimmy ate two hamburgers, and we're going to say, now that it's free, Jimmy can probably only stuff down one more hamburger. It never works that way. Jimmy brings a suitcase and 500 hamburgers in the suitcase, and somehow Jimmy goes from when he had to pay buying two hamburgers to now having 502 hamburgers. And we're stunned that it's 50% increases or 100% increases or whatever it is. So the reality is that was put in motion by Washington, D.C. nationwide. We cannot control it. The second thing they did was they said insurance companies will not be allowed to profit from this because we're going to make a new law which says however much they collect, they must spend 80% or 85%, whatever the number is, and their profit is limited. So an insurance company could raise the rate 50%, 90%, 100%, and their profit margins are not allowed to expand legally. So even the incentive, as greedy as they are, none of the rest of us are greedy, just them. But as greedy as they are, unlike the rest of us, that won't work for them. And the reason it won't work is because the same law that said it's all going to be free also said you can't raise your margins.
I'll just add a few more things, I guess, if you have any questions.
Well, it sounds like he's talking about introducing a little bit of cost sharing, at least at the beginning of that.
That's one of the things the governor has responded to about this, that he has all sorts of Arkansas Works proposals that are still awaiting federal approval and haven't been enacted yet that they're hoping would curb some of the costs, including cost sharing. But part of that is another private option angle, is that as the per person costs of those plans go up, so does the cost of the private option. And the private option which allows them to use Medicaid money for private insurance instead of Medicaid, only exists because the federal government gave them a rate cap for how expensive the plans can be. So, you know, there's some worry that if the plans go over the per-person rate cap, then they'd have to seek a new waiver to say that actually this costs more than we had planned in 2013. The federal government's response to all this across the nation, it's been similar stories. It's way worse elsewhere. Alabama's looking at 39%. Tennessee at 54%, Texas, which doesn't have Medicaid expansion, 57% increases, so Arkansas at 9.1% is still doing relatively well. But their answer is, well, the subsidies will still be there as a percentage of the insurance plan, so for actual consumers, it'll cost pretty much the same, maybe a little bit more, although the state and federal government will be paying more to subsidize it.
Meanwhile, we did also hear a little bit of news about the private option itself in terms of the number of people enrolled has increased quite a bit since we last checked in with it.
Yeah, I was at one committee earlier this week where they said it increased by like 30,000 in the past 3 months. And so I think the total, there's another update throughout the week, it's over 300,000 people. Is that something like that, that are enrolled in Medicaid expansion? So conservatives, especially those who like to quote then DHS Commissioner John Selig in 2013, he repeatedly assured everyone there's about 250,000 people in this program. It's only going to grow to 250,000. Well, we're well above that right now. But healthcare advocates say, good, these people who were too poor to otherwise get insurance have it. But it's obviously a stress on the state budget and for conservatives who don't want people to be on the program. The answer to that is, since it's all based on personal income levels, you have to raise people's incomes if you don't want them to be on the program.
All right, Sarah, this week we heard about the filing of a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas against the city of Sherwood. It involves a court there, which has been kind of dealing with hot check violations for the last several years and issuing court fines. And the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, here says it's, obviously it's violating the civil rights of these people who have come under the purview of this court. Could you explain exactly what the issue is?
So the ACLU filed a lawsuit this week against Sherwood, the city of Sherwood, and Pulaski County because the county has exclusively been sending hot check cases to this one court for many decades. And the complaint is that the court is giving prison time to people who've made hot checks and can't pay them and then can't pay the fees that the court's assigning them. So then they're sent to jail. And so that's one problem, is the ACLU says constitutionally, the court's supposed to assess whether the people have the ability to pay, and if not, give them other alternatives. Otherwise, it becomes a debtor's prison kind of situation. And then the other issues that they're claiming is that in this court, people are coming in and waiving representation and not being either given or allowed representation or told that they can have it. And then there's no written record or any kind of record of what happens in the court, and there never has been. And it's one judge who's taken over from his father, so it's been going on for as long as they know about it, although there's no record. So Bettina Brownstein, who's a lawyer for the ACLU, described what she called a hellish situation for the people who get into this courtroom with their hot checks.
Even in the instance where somebody, wrote a hot check and doesn't have a good excuse or reason, it's also the problem that you've talked about, all the due process violations and the illegality of what's going on, but it's the inability of the person to ever have a finite punishment. There's no way to stop being punished for this. So even if you want to, make somebody pay back what they wrote, fine, and you want to have some punishment, but this seems to be no end to it. You can't even go to jail long enough to work off your fine. People want to go to jail long enough so they don't have to pay their fine, but they're not even permitted to do that. So when they come out of jail, they still have a large fine to pay. It's just a never-ending punishment. It's just like hell.
The city of Sherwood, I spoke with the attorney, said they're not ready to comment about this. They're reviewing the allegation. And according to the ACLU, this is part of a larger national tackling what they call a war against the poor. It's not clear how prevalent this type of concern would be across Arkansas. They said some courtrooms it's done very well, and they believe there could be other problematic instances in the state, but not really clear.
So you said it's an issue that goes back decades. Has this court ever come under scrutiny before that you know of? Or did they say?
What they said was that they've known about this for a really long time. Neil Seeley was there, who's a community organizer in Little Rock, and they said they haven't had the institutional resources to take on this case until now, but it's a consortium of local lawyers and the ACLU partnering together to take this on. So they say everyone knew about it for a long time and they haven't been able to bring the suit yet.
It'd be kind of interesting to see if they change their procedures at all, I guess, like in the coming months, if they're going to respond to the lawsuit like in advance in their court, change of procedures. I don't know. I think it was David Kuhn in the Arkansas Times spent a day at the Sherwood Court, like the day after the lawsuit. And anyway, he's got an article up where he just was like, it was a constant run of people.
Well, earlier this year, we've mentioned this state house seat on the podcast before, after the unfortunate death of Representative Sheila Lampkin from Ashley County. Her seat is an open contest between Democrats and Republicans, but this week we heard that a Republican, Jacob, who's contesting that seat, has run into a little bit of legal trouble. Could you kind of take us through what his conviction is and whether or not he's serving jail time?
First of all, I have to correct the record here. Sheila Lampkin, although she represents Ashley County, she's from Monticello in Drew County.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
And there's a big division. I think, anyway, we'll get into that later.
I need to learn my South Arkansas geography.
Democratic nominating convention to replace Sheila Lampkin, Leanne Birch, a former U.S. Army Brigadier General, won. I think the votes were even split by county in the Democratic Party.
Oh, wow.
So it really matters, probably. Anyway, so we've got Jim Hall, who's been actually in legal trouble since 2013, was when he was first convicted of harassment charges. But he's been appealing and appealing and filing to run for office as well while he's doing this. He's running to be the state representative for the Republican Party. He won the primary there. So he's on the ballot. He got involved in a harassment suit against his ex-wife, her attorney, and her pastor, following a divorce and some child custody issues. It's pretty strange. His mother-in-law solicited his murder and was arrested for it by Drew County officials. But there's evidence she renounced it the next day after talking to one of her neighbors, saying that she wished he would just be disappeared. And that the judge there said there's something called a renunciation defense, that since she voluntarily, before anything happened, said she didn't want it done, that they're not going to continue charging her for it. So Jim Hall, in some ways, you could say, has been harassed himself. His mother-in-law's soliciting his murder. But he went to the Arkansas Court of Appeals this week. They upheld a lower court conviction of his harassment charges, which carries anywhere from 90 days in jail to a year in jail. He could get 90 days if he agrees to certain conditions upon his release. I spoke with Jim Hall on the phone, actually, the day that this came out, and he was in Little Rock at a conference to train legislative candidates on energy policy. So it didn't let him down. And he was also in Little Rock that day to file a stay to the state Supreme Court. But so here's Jim Hall in his own words. He's going to keep running.
I am not guilty. And if I have to vote absentee from the jail, I will do it. But I will refuse to withdraw from this race. I am not guilty of the allegations. And I will not spend one day in jail until I stand before the Supreme Court of the United States in an appeals process.
He seems pretty adamant. Well, staying in.
Not only that, he claims that he had a plea deal a long time ago, he wouldn't even face jail time, but he refused it.
So the pastor and my ex and her lawyer, they, through the prosecutor, made a deal, or an offer of a plea. I shut my mouth and quit talking about this stuff, pay a $500 fine, and it's over. I'm innocent. I decline.
Now, he claims that, in addition to the mother-in-law solicitation of murder charge, that his ex-wife physically abused his children that were his biological children and they were her adopted children. And he claims that he complained to DHS about that. And he claims his wife, who is a Mahoney family, and the Mahoneys have some renown, I believe, in the El Dorado area, that they conspired with DHS, specifically the director at the time, I can't remember her name at the moment, but to keep these allegations down to direct to give the children to the Mahonies instead of him. But he himself has passed DHS allegations against him in Oklahoma, which he voluntarily brought up to me. I want to keep this in mind that I called him on the phone and he talked for about 45 minutes and I maybe asked one question. So, but he claims that he's been exonerated in Oklahoma and wanted to prove his sanity to me, which I never questioned. But here is his defense of his sanity.
No allegations against me in Oklahoma were found to be true. And after six psychological evaluations that I was forced to take because of DHS's fraud and corruption in Oklahoma, I discovered that things are black and white with me. There's no gray area.
Right.
Actually proved by the psych eval, the last, which took me all day to do. I had a Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, and I went to one that they recommended. Mm-hmm. And he made me every test possible. Then a solar multiphasic test takes about 4 hours to take. I've got it down to an hour and 15 minutes. I've had to take it so many times because they kept saying I was cheating, that the results couldn't be true.
Yeah.
But this isn't wrong. We know this man has mental health issues. What that test proved was I am a Christian, I am a conservative, and I am a Republican.
So, you know, a man of conviction. Unfortunately for him, the local Drew County Republican Committee has totally rejected him, so much so that he tried to get on a special election ballot to fill the remaining couple months of Sheila Lampkin's term, and the Republican Party won't put him up on the special election ballot. Here's a statement from Chairman Doyle Webb. He says, in view of the Arkansas Court of Appeals affirming Jim Hall's conviction of harassment and harassing communications, which involved voicemails and Facebook posts, it is now obvious that he should focus on putting his personal life in order rather than running for public office. His actions don't reflect the values of the Republican Party of Arkansas. Therefore, I call on Jim Hall, House District 9 nominee, to resign his candidacy. However, Jim Hall doesn't really care what the Republican Party thinks of him.
For the Arkansas State House of Representatives in District 9, and I don't care if the entire Republican Party turns on me. They did that to Donald Trump. Look where he's standing at. People do not want Hillary in.
And he also characterized all this DHS stuff and the courts working against him as an overreach of the federal government, and that's why he's running for office.
How did he get involved in public service or the idea of wanting to be a public servant? I mean, what is his background?
Well, he claims, and this dates back to the time where he was investigated by DHS in Oklahoma, that he said everyone that knows him knows that he's been a child advocate and a child abuse advocate for many years. So he claims he's been involved in the DHS system in some way, a lot of it filing complaints, I believe, for a number of years. He also runs a blog, I can't remember the name of it right now, something like Conservative Watch Arkansas. And he also claims he's a victim of his blog, that's part of the reason he's being persecuted by local officials as well. He also ran for, I can't remember, a sheriff or something like that in the early 2010s, but I think a previous conviction or harassment thing also derailed that campaign.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what the voters decide.
It'll be interesting.
And also the courts.
Representative John Boehner, who is not seeking re-election in part because I think he was on the Ashley Madison website after he just got married. So, but he's a Democrat in neighboring Union and Ouachita and some other county down there. He said that if he is in jail and they have to cast votes, he's wondering if any Republican members will be willing to cast his vote for him in the House. So, I mean, I guess this has never happened before. It'd be pretty crazy if he won.
Well, Sarah, we've been talking a lot about prison overcrowding over the last few months, couple years, even in Arkansas, it still remains an issue. A lot of groups are working hard to try to address it in a wholesale way. We did hear about one consultant this week you covered, gave a presentation to the Criminal Justice Oversight Task Force, and they had some policy recommendations about how the state should deal with this overcrowding issue.
Yeah, so this is a group that's a part of the National Council of State Legislators. They're called the Justice Center, and they've given advice and done research on other states. And they've been doing for over a year, traveling around the state, visiting Arkansas and analyzing data about the prison system, and now they're coming out with the recommendations, and next month they'll come out with some monetary figures for how much cost would go with some of their ideas. The big picture problem that they've identified in more specificity maybe than we knew before, but they say that about 78% of the prison sentences in the state are given for minor property and drug crimes. So their big focus is how can we reduce prison costs by having sentencing reform that puts the people in jail who most need to be there. And this is controversial, of course, but they say that right now the state pays about $500 million a year to house the nearly 18,000 inmates it has. And in 10 years, if growth continues, it will be $1.3 billion a year. Arkansas has the fastest growing prison population in the country. So somewhat dire financial prospects for the state among social consequences there. So what they're recommending is, one, reviewing the sentencing guidelines and looking at how to change the rules so that the violent offenders are the people behind bars. Another big problem they've identified, and I spoke with a representative from the county association, he said about 30% of the county level jail population, which as we know there have been issues with overcrowding there for years, about 30% are people who are having mental illness crises and actually perhaps should not be in a prison population. So another possibility that they're suggesting, this group, is to fund crisis centers for mentally ill on the county level. Some counties apparently are really interested in this alternative and have some buildings they might repurpose for it. That could be a costly proposition because it would have to be clinician staffed. But of course, like many of these types of situations, you could project the possible cost savings. It's all starting to sound familiar with last year's legislative session, but then the other area is, you know, substance abuse treatment in the local level. Anyway, here's Andy Barbie talking about some of his recommendations.
These are recommendations that will be speaking to additional resources for community corrections, resources that would include caseworkers so that they can get those caseload sizes to a more manageable level. It would also include bolstering the availability of substance abuse treatment in the communities so that people who are on supervision and have addiction issues, that there's a more viable quality set of community supports to address those challenges. So that's kind of the first of the three main areas that the recommendations are touching on. The second main area that the recommendations are touching on has to do with ensuring that these really scarce and precious prison beds are truly focused on the most violent and dangerous and people with the greatest amount of criminal history. And so some of the recommendations, some of the options that we're putting forward to kind of address that are, one, looking at the sentencing guidelines. And that option has already been voted on by the task force back in March, but we're nonetheless kind of reminding them of it. Another one is speaking to capping the length of stay that low-level violators of supervision would face if they go all the way back to prison. So, for example, if your violation is failure of drug tests, missing a few appointments, maybe missing some payments, rather than being subject to a full revocation to prison, this option would limit the length of time that prison can be used as a sanction for those kinds of violations. You know, currently there's a lot of these more technical violators and they're spending a year or more in prison. And so we've got an option that would limit that length of time on those kinds of violators. So that kind of rounds out that second area of recommendations that are about making sure when we're sending people to prison, it's genuinely the most dangerous, the most violent, those with the greatest criminal history that would be sent there.
And then the last area is about the mental health treatment on the county level.
It's interesting he points out that issue about technical violations of parolees, because I think that was one of the main quote-unquote reforms that was in response to certain violations from a parolee that set all this in motion, and that led to a lot of the prison overcrowding that we see now.
Yeah, you're referring to the murder of Forrest Abrams, who's a teenager or young adult. Is Daryl Dennis the third, I think, was the...
Yeah, he was a multiple-time absconder. And
it is, yeah, it's interesting, though, because like the legislature, I guess 2 years ago, whenever it happened, a lot led by David Sanders, the Republican from West Little Rock and Maumelle, and the pendulum just swung totally the other way. We can't have any absconders. We've got to make sure that, you know, everyone is in jail that needs to be. And then the population goes up.
And one aspect of this issue that has been addressed this year in theory is the rearrest rate for parolees who were charged with minor crimes and then before even convicted, put sent back to jail. So I know the correction board voted on changing that rule in hopes of stemming the huge population that was coming back through that kind of glitch.
So I guess there's the legislature, what they can do, and then you just talked, Sarah, about the Sherwood Hot Check Court. That seems like it's something that has a lot of correlation with this. County jails, technical kind of things, not necessarily violent people.
Yeah, a complex web of different areas of the criminal justice system.
So, Chris, there have been a lot of talk this year about the election, some talk about some ballot issues like medical marijuana and the casino amendment and stuff like that. But there's also some local level stuff primarily involving alcohol that's on the ballot. There's some court cases caught up for some counties over technicalities also about which counties are going to be wet, which counties are going to be dry, and who's going to get to vote on it. Of course, in Pulaski County, I guess we don't think about it all the time because we're not a dry county.
No, but there are some dry areas in Pulaski County, which is beside the point right here. But this election season, there were about seven campaigns in different counties in one city to try to get this wet-dry issue on the ballot. So far, so we've reached the deadline where these different campaign committees have had to turn in their signatures to the county clerk to get the issue on the ballot. And so far, campaigners in Little River and Johnson counties just barely nudged past and going to get their issue on the ballot this November, as well as in the city of Farmington in northwest Arkansas. They have a pretty big hurdle. 38% of registered voters need to sign in this county need to sign the petition. And a lot of these campaigners point out, well, 38%, that's close to the total number of people that actually vote in elections at all. So it's a pretty high hurdle for all other kind of local petition drives for any other issue other than alcohol. They just need 15% of registered voters' signatures. So kind of an interesting set of requirements. So like I said, Little River County, Johnson County, they'll have their issues on the ballot. Petitioners in Crawford County are still collecting signatures. They were allotted more time to collect some signatures because their county clerk wasn't able to finish counting all the signatures that they had already turned in. So they're not like sure, they're kind of in a gray area. And that's another thing where county clerks don't necessarily have all the resources to count these, you know, thousands of signatures in some cases. I spoke with the Independence County clerk, for instance, and she had herself and four other employees were basically working 12 to 15 hour days over a 10-day period to try to verify signatures in Independence County. And that's also an area where there's a lawsuit that just had a hearing this week. The county clerk there, Tracy Mitchell, said this group, Keep Our Dollars in Independence County, was about just a few hundred signatures short reaching the ballot, getting that 38% threshold. The group filed a lawsuit against the clerk, alleging that, no, in fact, we did have enough valid signatures. You just invalidated some signatures that are on pages that had signatures from people who lived outside the county, which she is legally obliged to do, but this group alleges that it's unconstitutional. And so they had a hearing this week in the courtroom of Judge Tim Weaver in Independence County. He ruled in favor of the clerk, said that this issue was legal, it was not unconstitutional, even though there was a similar kind of lawsuit ruled by the state Supreme Court over almost the same kind of technicality, but it was on a statewide level, basically applying to only statewide petitions. Weaver said, well, that ruling doesn't apply to this. And so, you know, basically the Independence County people are out of luck. I spoke to one of them. This is Ross Jones. Keep our dollars in Independence County.
It's really about voter rights. This whole thing is about voter rights. We should have the right to vote on it, no matter what the issue. But the obstacles and snares and hurdles that are placed in the path of this one and only issue is in itself unconstitutional, is in itself completely stacked against the ballot, getting something to the ballot. And to me, that's just downright un-American.
So that's his opinion on it. And this does have some, you know, implications for the entire state. About half of counties in Arkansas are wet, about half are dry. In 2014, there was a failed ballot measure to get the whole state wet. So, I mean, it's probably a hurdle that other counties looking to go wet will encounter in the future. There's also a similar lawsuit basically on the same issue as this Independence County one being heard in Randolph County. Their county clerk also invalidated a few hundred signatures because of the same issue where there are some out-of-county signatures on the same page as these. And they just fell short. The hearing is going on this week. We haven't had a judgment in that one yet. Probably we'll hear back today, but not sure exactly.
Some of the backers of that law that changed it so that you can't have a single person from the wrong county or wrong area on the list, I'll throw them out, were Oaklawn and Hot Springs and Southland and West Memphis. And the speculation was why they supported that is because they didn't want a casino amendment to be on the ballot because there are two quasi-casinos. All of a sudden there'd be competition. So they wanted to discourage those kind of efforts.
Right. And also other groups opposing these measures, County Line Liquor Stores, for instance, have funded opposition groups. Independence County is right next to Jackson County, which is wet. It's where Newport is. A lot of the business for alcohol sales goes to Newport. Walmart has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to these various campaigns in support of the wet issue, I guess, in support of alcohol sales in these counties. So it's interesting to see who's backing what side. Obviously, Walmart has a financial stake in getting this, but it'll be interesting to see whether or not the Independence County folks will appeal the ruling and whether or not Randolph County will see what that judgment is. And in Crawford County, we're still not sure whether or not they have the required number. But if you're in Johnson County or Little River County, you get to decide on this thing. Well, with that, we are done. Thanks for listening. This is the KUAR Week in Review podcast. Find us on iTunes, wherever else you get your podcasts. We're on KUAR.org. We do this every week, trying to round up the best news for you. We are an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Check out our news stories on the web. Listen, KUAR 89.1 FM in Little Rock in Central Arkansas. Goodbye. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek.
Thank you.